This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Hugh Rimmington. Welcome to The Roundtable. Well, as politicians race around the country over the next 3 weeks looking for votes, there is one growing constituency of Australians who are unlikely to get much of a look-in. Every night, more than 100,000 Australians have nowhere safe to sleep. Whatever we think we are doing is not working. The numbers are growing, easily outstripping population growth, with one in every 150 Australians nowadays without a secure roof. And it's not easy to pass it off anymore as something that could never happen to us. So why is it rising so fast? Who is most vulnerable? And where are the growth rates in homelessness most acute? If you have views or experience on this subject, feel free to text us on 0418 226 576, or you can hit us up on Twitter using the handle at Radio National. Now, at the roundtable today, we're joined by Tali Starr, who experienced homelessness for 5 years and is now a consultant with Homelessness New South Wales. Jenny Smith is chair of Homelessness Australia and the CEO of the Council to Homeless Persons. And James Toomey is head of Mission Australia. Hello to all of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. Tali, can I start with you? How did you first come to experience homelessness?
So I came to experience homelessness through leaving domestic violence. And prior to that, my life was working part-time, but working and doing a music career.
And what was it like when you crossed the threshold from the homed to the unhomed?
I think that was the most surprising time of my life, probably the most traumatic time of my life. I thought leaving domestic violence would be hard, but actually what came after that was so much harder.
What was your experience?
So once I left, I then had to engage with a whole lot of government organisations which unfortunately work in a system of power and control. So I left an abuser who was in that power and control system, and then I was thrown into more systems that were like that. So every time I engaged with the system, it was like, we're going to tell you what to do. This is how you have to do it. And then you'd do that and you'd come back and it was wrong. You had to do it a different way. So while you're trying to deal with trauma, trying to come through what you come through, you then had to deal with, you were filling out the wrong forms, you had to engage with people who were often combative, and it actually made it so much worse.
So the notion that if you get yourself in some sort of strife where events are gone against you, but that there is a warm and empathetic support system out there ready to welcome you, that wasn't what you found?
No warm and empathetic system. And most people actually struggled to believe that I left a domestic violence situation.
When you say most people, you mean people in authority or family or?
Yeah, the people that were around me at the time. So I was in a church at the time and I said to them that I had left a domestic violence situation, and their response was, why did you not come to talk to me?
About before you left?
Before I left,
wow.
Yeah.
What was the sort of housing option that was available to you as you started to sort of learn this new world? What were the kind of things that were being offered up?
So I was currently in a rental, and because of the Centrelink way that they had to do it, I had to then go and speak to my landlord and tell her that I needed her to fill out a form because I'd left my ex. She then took the opportunity to put my rent up about $140. So then I was not able to afford to live there. I then had to find somewhere else, and I couldn't find places because there was 50 other people going. And then it basically became a treadmill of trying to find affordable housing, not being able to find it, moving into places with people I didn't know, which made things more unsafe for me. And then it meant finding another rental property, then that rent was put up $100, and then finding another one, and that was a shoebox for $250. It just was a ridiculous merry-go-round, basically.
Did you have kids through this?
No, I had animals, though, and it's very hard to get rental properties with animals as well.
And so people said to you, well, why do you bring animals? Just jettison the animals.
They did actually say that to me, and my response to them was, my animals give me a reason to get up in the morning. They're my family. I don't have any other family. So they're my support to get through all of this harshness, to have this comfort and love from an animal.
Wow. Okay, so Jenny Smith from Homelessness Australia, when you hear this story from Tali, how common is it? How much is it? We see this fast rise in women in particular becoming homeless. Is this a sort of fairly typical type of story?
Well, I'm very distressed to hear that, you know, Tali had such a hard time and not always a warm response from government officials and perhaps some service providers. But we're in a situation where homelessness is increasing by at least about 4% every year. Each year we're having more than 288,000 people come to our homeless services seeking support, and our services are just not able to cope and are turning more than 230 people away every day. And I think it is very confronting when you think that of those people coming to our services, 40% are parents with children, and more than 60% are women and girls like Tali. I think everyone's overwhelmed. There isn't a plan in place to turn this around, and we're just seeing housing unaffordability, rising rents, almost 200,000 people nationally on our public housing waiting lists. It's a recipe for disaster.
The raw statistics indicate that it is still men who make up most of the homeless in Australia. Jenny Smith, are you suggesting that the mix is changing with time?
Well, I think, excuse me, I've got a little bit of a cough. Look, I think the census figures lean a little bit towards men, but we see slightly more women and children and young people coming to our services looking for help. And I think in historically in times of economic downturn, I think that picture of men out of work, men with perhaps alcohol and drug problems, unskilled labour, is the picture in our minds that we still have of who is homeless in this country. But we have to accept that predominantly these days it's women and children and young people who are forced out of the housing market and not able to compete for rentals, and for whom we do not have a systematic plan.
Well, let's talk about, we're going to break this down a little bit more, but let's talk about those young people. On some figures, 38% of the people who are homeless on any given night are under the age of 25. James Toomey from Mission Australia, why are young people entering, you know, their vigorous, active, healthy parts of life in such numbers without a roof?
Well, a lot of it's economic. The rental accommodation for, in general, and it's been covered by the other participants too, very high cost of rental, very difficult to get into rental accommodation, easy for landlords to put up rent, as we heard in Tali's situation. You know, young people then are having to engage in temporary housing type of situations, either ones which are organised or doing a thing called couch surfing, which sounds like really great, but is horrible in reality, where you wake up every day and you don't know whose friend's floor you're going to sleep on that night, or where you're going to sleep that night, and you may move around and be physically in a building and not rough sleeping, but in a kind of hidden homelessness, and this is one of the categories of hidden homelessness that we talk about. Trying to engage, trying to be economically engaged, some working. No, homeless people work. It's not the case that the sort of stereotypical view of everybody who's homeless is not working. That's not the case at all. And in this cohort of young people, many of them are working, making an economic contribution, but are simply unable to afford appropriate accommodation for their needs and live in either those temporary situations or significantly overcrowded dwellings or other unsuitable accommodation, because they're trying to keep a roof over their heads and keep working.
There's this kind of almost self-comforting belief that the homeless are predominantly old men who drink too much or possibly gamble too much or have some other issue, and whatever the miseries of their lives have been largely brought upon themselves. This is not the profile that you're offering, James.
That's absolutely right. And certainly, that Most people's perception of homelessness is what they see on the streets of big cities, of people who are rough sleeping. And rough sleepers make up about 7 to 8% of homeless people. It's a significant number of people, but by no means is it that in a majority of homeless people. Homeless people are living in severely crowded accommodation, living in temporary accommodation not suitable for their needs, living in shelters, moving through temporary accommodation, living in boarding houses. All sorts of different ways of actually not having a permanent and appropriate roof over your head is what constitutes homelessness. So the little snapshot that people get when they look on the street, and if they think, oh, that's a distillation of, that's a representation of the homeless population. So if you look at those people and multiply it to turn it into 116,000, which is the homeless people every night, then that's the profile. Is a totally distorted profile, because the people that you see rough sleeping are not representative necessarily of other people who are homeless.
And Tali, as you were going through this experience yourself, who are the kind of people that you were meeting? What was the kind of stories? Were you meeting other people in the same circumstances as you were being turned away from places or struggling to find a place? Did you get a sense that there is this sort of subculture in Australian life of people who are really struggling, unnoticed largely by the rest of the community?
Yeah, I think I probably noticed it. That frog's come back in my throat.
Caught it from Jenny.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's been since that time I've noticed and learned more about people, that I've come across people that are all in the same situation. So my situation was also couch surfing, trying to find a bed in a room. And so in that space, you're so desperately trying to find where you can go next that you're not necessarily fully aware of what's going on around you. And then when you start to connect in with other groups and you hear how hard it is for them, and then there's no place for them to go, and some of them have children, you know, there was a whole closure of a whole lot of places that people could go. And so now there's even less places for people to find somewhere when they have to leave.
And Jenny, according to the stats, again, women over 65 who are homeless has tripled since the census of 2011. What is this epidemic of homelessness among older Australian women?
Well, if you think about it, women, because of child-rearing, tend to be in and out of the workforce over the course of their adult life. While they're working, statistically, they earn less than men, and in that context then have a smaller nest egg of superannuation. But in the context of a partnership, may well still expect to have a comfortable retirement. But if that relationship breaks up, or a health problem emerges, or there's an unexpected death of a partner, women can find themselves on their own and absolutely without insufficient funds to be able to purchase a home. And so it's with the erosion of Centrelink incomes generally, the pension is very much part of that. And so trying to live as a single person on the pension, renting these days, is a very, very miserable hand-to-mouth lifestyle. And so
there
we're
must
increasingly
be
seeing.
There must be a level of utter desperation to that, because, you know, you can still have some optimism in your younger days that maybe, you know, the corner might be turned or whatever. But if you're on a pension and unable to find secure housing, there's unlikely to be any sort of happy rainbow to slide along that you can possibly see. It must be incredibly desperate.
Yes, and I was in a forum about a year ago with a couple of nurses heading towards 60 who were working part-time, and both of whom were victims of family violence and were finding the work too heavy, certainly didn't have, were in that financial scenario I've just outlined, and they were both quite calmly contemplating suicide.
Wow. Let's talk about some potential solutions. If there was a single thing, Jenny Smith from Homelessness Australia, that could be done, what would it be? What do governments need to do? What does anyone need to do?
Oh, look, I think we have to accept that our problem is the gap between incomes and housing affordability. And it's at its most extreme for people on our lowest incomes, and the market is not going to take care of that. Government has to come to the party with subsidised housing, with social housing. And that is the biggest thing that we need to focus on. We talk a lot about crisis accommodation, we talk a lot about supports, and we need those things, but without a plan and without a definite strategy to develop a supply of housing that people on our lowest incomes can afford, we're just going to see that 4% increase a year in homelessness continue and, I would believe, escalate.
So social housing is one element. What about income increases? People on Newstart, you know, people on the minimum wage, particularly those on part-time, people on pensions?
Yes, I think we've, as a sector, been calling for an increase. I believe even John Howard, our former Conservative Prime Minister, has agreed that the Centrelink income is too low and that it's got to be increased. But we've got this is a very complex problem. You know, single variable solutions are not going to work. Housing is our biggest market. It's the most sensitive market in our country, and it really is a complex beast. So we need a plan that looks at incomes, that looks at the cost of housing, and looks at the taxation and planning levers to make sure that, you know, everyone in every circumstance in Australia can have a stable roof over their head.
James Toomey, of those solutions being suggested, how do they chime with you?
Oh, I would agree with all of those, and absolutely right. And Jenny says that the fundamental underpinning issue is a shortage of social and affordable homes in Australia, we would say, and as part of a group of people in the Everybody's Home campaign, would say, you know, 500,000 is the number of the shortfall in social and affordable homes. And I think it's really important to recognise that, yes, government has to come to the party, so do organisations like Mission Australia in our sector, but also planners, architects, you know, local councils. It has to be a shared approach to make a real difference to this number, and to make sure that housing is actually not just any old housing is built anywhere, but that appropriate, suitable housing is built in proximity to transport and to work and to schools and education. Housing viewed as essential infrastructure. There's a lot of commentary around you know, investment in essential infrastructure in Australia. Social housing is essential infrastructure if
you want to. It's not just roads, is what you're saying.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
You're nodding, Tali.
Yes, I am. I think we just keep getting rid of properties, and we're not making more properties, and we are not making suitable properties, and there's properties that have been run down. I think I got offered a number of properties and they just were not suitable for me yet. The whole idea was that I was actually fighting the system rather than, you know, trying to work with them to house me.
How are they not suitable?
So I'm quite allergic to mould. So some of them were full of mould. So I couldn't live in that because I'm an asthmatic. Some of them were in unsafe areas. Some of them were highly built up. And as someone leaving a domestic violence situation, I need to feel safe, not in a big complex of people. They just didn't consider the factors, and they reduced the amount of factors you could actually put for what you needed. And I just think one of the big factors that's forgotten is that these are people, and we need to treat people as individuals. We need to understand what their needs are and their situation is, and we need to try and house them so that they can stay housed and that they can actually build a future for themselves, if that's possible.
We're complaining there's not enough housing.
Is yeah, it? That's right.
Simple supply and demand. The demand is too great. I want to read, we're getting a number of messages coming through, but I want to read this. It's coming from Carol, who describes herself as a 65-year-old woman. She was in a relationship most of her life, and then her business fell apart. The relationship fell apart. She says she now lives in another world. She says that she has no superannuation. She's at the mercy of the system. She's not used to living in substandard homes. If it wasn't for emergency support from my family at the worst times, I would be homeless. I don't see any hope in sight. And that's a message from Carol. It's very, very bleak, isn't it, Jenny?
Yes, and I think Carol speaks to the size of the problem, because so many of us, when we're faced with these unexpected circumstances, do have family and friends to lean on. And so the 288,000 people coming to our services each year are people who are not in that situation of having those sorts of supports. So the numbers of people, you know, experiencing housing stress, estimates say more than 800,000 households, are really just an unexpected loss or crisis away from facing the sorts of things that Carol's just described.
And that business of having family support, I notice that 46% of the people who are homeless are born overseas, they're migrants essentially. 20% are Aboriginal people, even though only roughly 3% of the population is Aboriginal, so that's hugely overrepresented there in those numbers. Is there, particularly if you look at those migrant numbers, the fact that you don't have generational sort of depths of kind of family support group has a, is a factor, James, in these outcomes?
Yeah, I think absolutely. So, and also, I mean, we heard from Tali. Tali, you know, educated, engaged person who, you know, English is a first language, et cetera, et cetera. If you have none of those advantages, how can you navigate a system? You heard Tali's story about how the difficulty of navigating the system of being pushed back to square one, fill in another form, this housing is unsuitable, et cetera, et cetera. You know, how would you begin to navigate that if English isn't your first language and you don't read English? You might not even read your first language. In some cases, you know, people have low levels of literacy, even low levels of literacy who are English speaking. And so engaging with the system is very challenging. So that high number of people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds speaks, yes, to the issue of not having a natural family, if you like, or an intergenerational support network available to you, but also cultural challenges of how to access services and support, not knowing what's available. And then at entry points of trying to engage with the system, finding the system complicated and you know, just a maze of complication for you. And then stigma. You know, one of the things we haven't talked about is a huge stigma associated with homelessness. So an underrepresentation, we would say, and I'm sure Jenny would say the same thing, of actual homeless numbers. The homeless, the census takes a snapshot in time, and it's a very, very powerful piece of information that it gives us. But underrepresented there will be people fleeing domestic violence situations who probably won't want to say where they are on census night, because if you're concerned about, you know, your where you are, you're not going to share that information. Young people in those transitional living arrangements that I talked about, they probably won't be picked up accurately in the census. And people who are from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds not being picked up too. In some cases, people come from circumstances of oppression where they would fear that if they fill in a form that says, I've got nowhere to live, and this form goes off to the government and they collect all the information, that the next thing I'm going to get is a knock at the door and someone's going to be saying, you know, what are you doing here? We found out about you. So an understanding of if you like, the confidentiality of a census may not be there. So this underrepresentation.
So it's a big problem, bigger than the numbers necessarily even show. Is it also a problem that has no votes in it?
Absolutely. Absolutely right, Hugh. There are, sadly, no votes in homelessness. And because the general public perception is that the people they see rough sleeping on the streets of major cities and other regional towns make up the homeless population. They think that it's people's fault that they are homeless. Yeah. And we've heard from Tali and also from Carol on the message really good examples of what I would describe as, you know, fully paid up members of society who've paid tax and they've contributed economically throughout their lives. They've taken time out of the workforce and had children, and then find themselves in situations of a small change in circumstance, loss of a job, an illness, and suddenly find themselves grappling with a homeless system which is not designed to meet the needs of people like that. So you absolutely have a unfortunately a very stereotypical view of people who are homeless, which I think clouds people's judgment. And people get very quickly into a sense of, well, it's people's fault. And you touched on some stereotypes earlier, the sort of drunken, older, single man, sleeping under a blanket with a, you know, bottle of metho. You know, we're talking years ago, that kind of stereotype. And that's absolutely not the case.
How do you make it an election issue, Jenny Smith?
Yes, well, I think it is difficult. I think the conversation in the country has changed, and I think the sort of standard barbecue conversation of maybe a decade ago, everyone was very excited about how much the value of their the house they're buying had gone up in a short time, didn't have any component of it thinking about the consequences, and the consequences of that disproportionate increase in the value of housing is people who can't afford to have housing. And we think of ourselves as an egalitarian society, but increasingly we are becoming a community of haves and have-nots. 93% of negative gearing is for existing properties and existing owners. And we're, you know, going to end up more of a community that has gated communities and ghettos.
You mentioned negative gearing. Do you have any concerns about, I don't want to bring sort of partisan politics into this, but the Labor Party policy of shutting down investor tax breaks for negative gearing? Some economists say will have the effect of putting up rents because there'll be fewer investors attracted to that investment vehicle. Have you done any work on that to see whether...
No, I mean, I think we're all united in saying that the concessions, the tax concessions in negative gearing and capital gains tax need to be changed, and they are creating housing as an investment, not as something that provides homes for people. And look, what I said earlier around this being a very complex market that requires very sophisticated thinking and very careful tweaking, you know, means that sort of, you know, single variable actions can be dangerous. So it does need to be done, but it needs to be done very, very thoughtfully.
There's another message that's come through. We're getting a lot of messages here. This one doesn't have a name to it, but it says, please acknowledge that Aboriginal and Islander people routinely miss out on rental housing because of racism, Australia's big swear word. James Toomey, would you say that's true?
I think it's Australia's big swear word, and I think the central piece around developing or creating housing which is suitable for the needs of the people who are going to live in them, or the intended occupants of them, rather than housing which is easy to build or convenient to build, gets to the heart of creating appropriate housing solutions for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. If you take a view which is that housing needs to be designed in ways in the way that people want to live in it, then it's more likely to produce suitable housing. And there, absolutely, we see, you've talked about 20% of homeless people in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander. But and 3-4% of the population, but that number 20-25% crops up in just about every indicator of social disadvantage in Australia in relation to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people: populations of prisons, populations in psychiatric hospitals, populations of homeless people, populations of people who are not working, or etc. Comes up again and again and again, and it's a major component. And picking up something that Jenny said, indicates there isn't a silver bullet to solve this.
Okay, well, hopefully we've put this somewhat on the agenda for the election, and I'm very grateful to our guest today, Tali Starr, who's experienced homelessness over a period of 5 years, now a consultant with Homelessness New South Wales. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
To Jenny Smith, the chair of Homelessness Australia, and to James Toomey, who's the head of Mission Australia. And before we go, I should say that if this discussion has raised any issues for you, you can call 1-800-RESPECT. Also, the lifeline number 13 11 14. I'm Hugh Rimmington. You're listening to RN. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll be back with another roundtable next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.